This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. So this week, we're going to continue on to our topic about love, sex, dating, and relationships. And this is with psychologist Dr. Doug Lyle. He's been in practice. How long have you been in practice for?
I don't know. Too long. Many decades.
All right. Well,
doing clinical work for over 30 years.
Wow. Yeah. That's quite a long time to do a lot of clinical work, and especially with this perspective of, you know, using the type of perspective that you bring to this practice, to your practice, is something I'm sure is a very big pioneering thing to do.
Yes, it's these are really quite new ideas in psychology, and then figuring out how to apply them effectively has been sort of what I've been up to since the early 90s.
Great. Well, before we begin with the questions, I have a little clip to play you, and this is a satire clip. It represents the conflict and the arguments that men and women have when they're in a relationship, or when they were dating, or when they're friends and they're trying to solve a problem, and the man is always trying to solve the problem and find how to fix it, whereas the woman more wants to just talk about the problem and express her feelings. And of course, this is a satire. It's a satire of a man and woman on a couch, and the woman has a nail that's stuck in the middle of her forehead. So let's hear this.
Just, there's all this pressure, you know? And sometimes it feels like it's right up on me, and I can just feel it, like literally feel it in my head, and it's relentless. And I don't know if it's going to stop. I mean, that's the thing that scares me the most, is that I don't know if it's ever going to stop.
Yeah. Well, you do have a nail in your head.
It is not about the nail.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, I'll bet if we got that out of there.
Stop trying to fix it.
No, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm just pointing out that maybe the nail is causing...
You always do this. You always try to fix things when what I really need is for you to just listen.
No, see, I don't think that is what you need. I think what you need is to get the nail
out. See, you're not even listening now.
Okay, fine. I will listen. Fine.
It's just, sometimes it's like there's this achy, I don't know what it is. And I'm not sleeping very well at all. And all my sweaters are snagged. I mean, all of them.
That sounds really hard.
Ow!
Oh, come on. Ow. If you would just...
Don't!
Try to think. And at the end, they try to kiss and make up. And...
Right. Oh, my God. That's just beautiful. Priceless.
Yeah. Yeah. So, is this satire? Is this how men and women really do try to approach things?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some truth in this, and this is, you know, John Gray, the pop psychologist, you know, writing 20 years ago or whenever it was when he wrote Mars and Venus. This was his sort of one insider. He beautifully and comically told this story, which led to the phenomenal success of Mars and Venus. And it's clearly a stereotype with truth in it, as many stereotypes do have grains of truth. And this is clearly a man-woman difference, no question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I saw this clip. My sister showed it to me, and it was just hilarious because the woman clearly has a nail in her head, and every guy in the world would look at this problem and say, "You've got this problem," and all the girl wants to do is just talk about it. So it was really, really funny. But let's move on to the questions that that some of the users on the forum posted. The first one that I want to go over question is it actually talks about evolutionary psychology. And this notion that human nature is what drives our decisions rather than, say, our our childhood or our traumas or anything like that. And the question this user asked is, why are people so offended by this idea that human nature drives our decisions?
Well, that's a really complicated question. And there isn't one answer to this. I think that certainly... I mean, we could go down a list of potential motivations of why this is very upsetting for so many people, but one of them is that people do not like to be don't like to see themselves as animals, and we sort of have separated ourselves out from the animal kingdom, and we think of ourselves as essentially free agents operating or hovering above the animal kingdom. And we don't place ourselves within the animal kingdom, and with some justification, because human beings are clearly spectacular in some ways, but you don't see other animals, doing many of the things that humans do. So I can understand why people, it's like, well, if you can build and drive a Ferrari, doesn't this just make you above everything else? And above the sort of lower quote unquote instincts or behavior of lower animals. And the answer is no, it really doesn't. It makes you a chimpanzee with a fancy toy that a chimpanzee with a remote controller for a TV in front of it. The truth is that no human being can build a Ferrari. No human being can do that. No 10 human beings put together could build a Ferrari. The Ferrari is built on the back of tens of thousands, or actually probably millions, of individual expertise and all kinds of different things collectively. So the truth of the matter is the individual that's driving it is a very fancy, very smart, souped-up chimpanzee. And human beings don't really have that clear, and it offends their feelings of their own status to see themselves sort of lowered in that way. So that's one reason. And another reason is that people don't like, there's a right around the corner from this is the notion that genes are super powerful and that are highly determinative of action. And not too far away from that is the notion that individual differences in genetics are going to account for the individual differences that we see in humans. And this is very offensive for people, partly for the reasons of historical processes that took place around the world in the early 20th century, a la eugenics, Adolf Hitler, etc. And so those notions were very, very offensive, and they were so offensive that post-World War II in academia in the United States, if you even breathe the word of the concept that individual genetic variation had anything to do with outcomes in people, you were essentially more or less kicked out of academia and seen as not being appropriately open-minded and actually being fascist and being hateful and divisive and everything else under the sun. And so that lingers on in the spirit of political correctness, particularly in the United States and also elsewhere, but particularly in the United States. And so as a result, people sort of feel like if you start to realize that individual genetic variation, or you start to say that it has a lot to do with individual variation in outcomes, then you are constraining some individuals, people, or their children, for example, to certain socioeconomic strata potentially, or other strata, heterosexual attractiveness strata, athletic strata, etc. And people don't like the idea that their freedom to rise or their freedom to essentially work hard and then trump other, you know, competitors is actually constrained by genetic variation. And so that offends people. You will hear parents very upset at any concept that their children be told that they cannot do something. It's like, oh, well, you can do anything. It's like, well, no, actually, you can't. If you're a 5 foot six inch male, you're not going to be playing center for your high school basketball team. It's not going to happen. Just that fast, we're going to hit the constraints. If you are of moderately average above intelligence, you are not going to be a rocket scientist. That's not going to happen. And there's no amount of studying that you're going to do that's going to make up for it. So, but these, that kind of talk sounds very dismissive and elitist. And that disturbs people. It makes them feel like they're going to be shut out, or their genes, i.e. their offspring, may be shut out. And they don't like that. And so that's another thing that offends people. So it also is true that man-woman differences that are very apparent to evolutionary theorists, this disturbs women because women like to believe, or they have a hovering belief, that that men are being, quote, bad when they have wandering eyes. That men that would want to have several sex partners at the same time during a course of their lifetime, or many sexual partners in their lifetime, but particularly more than one in a given time period, this is bad. This is essentially a moral failure, or et cetera. And so the female, I'm not saying this is all females, I'm just stereotyping this, but these are very, very clear main effects of human psychology, that because the male tendency to have a wandering eye is quite powerful, and it is in direct contradiction to what a female may want out of a relationship with a given male, that she sees any explanation from biology as essentially giving him moral equivalency over his tendencies versus her tendencies. And this is very threatening and upsetting, because the female is wanting to be on the moral high ground, believes she is on the moral high ground. And when evolution says, no, actually, you are not on the moral high ground at all, that these two tendencies are absolutely morally equivalent, this is very disturbing. And so that will also upset people. And I'll just say one more thing and then we're done. It's also true that evolutionary theory basically sweeps aside other theories of how it is that we came to be and what our purpose is and who we answer to. So it pretty well sweeps away religion. And not that you might not believe in certain religious tenets and also believe in evolution. People can have those two thoughts in their head and have them essentially not having computed their way through and understanding that those two things are contradictory. Some people are unaware that those are in contradiction, that they are logically in contradiction. But the notion that those are potentially contradictory is also something that is going to upset people, and it's been upsetting people since 1859 when Darwin published The Origin. So many, we see sexual issues between people. We see individual differences within populations being upsetting. We see the very notion of human creation and our quote purpose to be challenging. We see quite a number of problems with evolutionary theory and why this is upsetting people.
Yeah, because this is equivalent to Copernicus, when he figured out that the whole solar system, you know, were revolving around the sun rather than the other way around, and it seems equivalent to the Earth being somebody telling us that the Earth is, you know, flat or round or whatever the prevailing theory was, and it seems as though people get as upset about this as when doctors were told that they have to wash their hands in between surgeries and autopsies.
Yes. Yeah, this is, in fact, when you really get down to it, there this is probably more upsetting than just about anything else, because it's attacking human personal interests and their status in a variety of dimensions. Number one, you're just another animal. Okay. Number two, men and women are significantly different, and male's wandering eye is not a sign of moral weakness. Number three, you were created by an evolutionary process, not by a supreme being that sculpted you to some kind of magnificent perfection in his or her image or whatever. Number four, the individual differences between people that you observe are largely genetic in origin, and many of those are not subject to much modification, and so therefore they're going to have enormous consequences for human success in a variety of pursuits, financial, athletic, and in terms of sheer sexual attractiveness. Your sexual attractiveness is almost entirely dependent upon your genetic variation, and almost not at all dependent on anything that you can learn, do, or, you know, mimic or anything else.
So all those articles in Cosmopolitan magazine and all the articles in the men's magazines that tell women if you say this particular magical phrase, you'll get the guy to marry you or to commit to you. And it's likewise for the men. If you say this magical, you know, technique and you run these routines, you'll magically have all this casual sex. That's absolutely not true, is what you're saying.
Yeah, actually, I was just in an airport and I was walking past something and it was a magazine cover. I don't know. It's one of the magazine covers just out this month. It was just a couple of days ago. And it said what to say to women, you know, the sneaky or the secret words to say to women to get them into bed or something. I thought, there it is. You know, there's no end to people selling you snake oil on how to get a magical advantage in these processes. The truth is that you can improve your station to some degree, and in some cases significantly, through a hell of a lot of hard work and maybe some good luck. But the majority of the outcomes with respect to your intellectual abilities, your physical abilities, your sexual attractiveness, the majority of the variance in humans is right there at the level of it's who your parents were, not what it is that they taught you.
Hmm. Well, so then the things that can be done is basically understanding, all these magazine covers and the magic, I've always considered them as beefing up the marketing system of the marketplace. Whereas,
let me explain what they're really doing. What they're really doing is that they are attempting to make you an offer that you can't refuse. So if someone is telling you, well, if you send me $5, I'm going to give you back $25, there's going to be a sucker that is going to say, wow, I got to do that. And this is how Ponzi schemes work, okay, that the rate of return is just too good to be true. And so this is exactly how they sell everything that they can these days, is that they make phenomenal and extravagant promises. And somebody will buy it because somebody's hoping that they can tap into some magic that will give them an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And because, remember, let's suppose you had an honest man who said, I have a stock portfolio that I've done a lot of research, and I believe that I can get you a 5.7 rate of return in the next 5 years each year. I'm pretty sure that I can do it. Now, that guy has no chance because somebody else is going to look at the same data and say, I can get you 7.5. And then somebody else is going to say, I can get you 13.5. And then somebody else is going to say, I can get you 15.5. And then somebody else will say, I can double your money every year. Okay. And so where is our guy that has got it figured out that he can give you 5.7% rate of return? He's nowhere. Nobody's paying any attention to him because the marketplace is screaming that they've got a better value proposition on their corner of the marketplace. And so that's all the magazine covers are, is saying, I've got a better deal for you than anybody else has for this thing that I know is extremely important to you. which is to, if you're a woman, it's to land a high quality mate permanently. And if you're a man, it's to land a whole bunch of good looking casual sex out of a number of females.
Well, it seems to be working for them because all these, those are multi-billion dollar industries, right?
Yes.
People want to believe the magic.
Keep selling the same. Of course.
Yeah.
Like this is what the vitamin pill industry is. I mean, this
right.
is, this is exactly how, this is how snake oil is sold. Mm-hmm. And that's, it's simply, you simply need to do, all you need to do is you need to get within the tolerance limits of the human reasoning capabilities. And some humans aren't very smart. And so as a result, they can't compute realistic probabilities, and their money is just as good as a Caltech, scientist's. So I think it's entertaining when people argue about the fine points of politics, when the truth is Johnny Lunchbucket with an 80 IQ and a job washing windows, his vote counts just as much as the Nobel Prize winners in economics. And the same thing is true in the marketplace of stuff. So it isn't the quote best, most effective, most truthful product doesn't win. What wins is the one that manages to capture the hype. And the hype is all about value proposition. The organisms that are watching these advertisements and trying to make decisions are running cost-benefit analyses. And if it looks like your benefit is better than the other guy's benefit for a similar cost, they're going to buy your product.
Very interesting. Okay, so now let's wrap this around and let's start the let's continue on from the last couple of weeks about love, sex, and dating,
because
I love this topic about evolutionary psychology, and it is a really broader topic, and you go over some of the common things that people go under on your website, esteemdynamics.org, and talking about this concept of beating the genes. But a couple of weeks ago, in our show, you mentioned that, and this is from a user who commented, but his name is Ceres. He mentioned that, so you mentioned a couple of weeks ago that initially in the history of our evolution, men had very high lust and females went only for the best looking males, while men just kind of went for whatever they could get their hands on. And so this user's question is, does this suggest that women always had a higher standard or higher standard of mating strategy and higher lust?
And it wouldn't be higher lust. That's a mistake. Women's sexuality would have been much more conditional than male sexuality. So think about this, that if the women are working very hard to figure out who the specific best male is, then the women's sexuality should be under a great deal of inhibition. So when they bump into a male, they're probably going to say, no, I don't think so. And then they're going to bump into another one and say, no, I don't think so. And they're going to bump into another one and say, no, I don't think so. They are looking for the one that makes them weak in the knees. Okay. And so the female's sexual psychology is under a great deal of constraint relative to male sexual psychology. This is not just true in humans. This is a trans-species phenomenon. Women, females have more at stake in copulation than males do because of the possibility of pregnancy. They're going to make a greater investment in the offspring than the male is going to make. So as a result, they have to be more discerning about their mating choices, and this is, of course, true in the human female. The males are going to be much less discriminating. So the males are, in most species, have no discrimination whatsoever. In other words, they're basically like, if it's female and it'll have sex with you, do it. And the answer is they probably won't do it because you have to be very fancy relative to other males in order for them to be willing. Now, in our species, what has happened is something very interesting, which rarely does happen, but it can. And that is that the males started to invest in offspring. And if males are going to invest in offspring rather than just screwing and leaving in the woods, then they are going to have to, then sex is going to wind up being a much more investment-laden process for them. And so as a result of that, they are going to then start making discriminations about the females that they're having sex with. And so starting probably about 2 million years ago, what was the dawn of what we're going to call pair bonding, or what you would call love, in our species, where there would be an attachment between the male and the female, and there'd be repetitive sexual activity, not just once and gone. This characteristic starts to be selected for. And as that's happening, the males are no longer indiscriminate. They start to be like females. Remember, the females were highly discriminating, because they're trying to pick only the fanciest male. But now the male starts to be discriminating, and he starts to develop what we're going to call mating search images that include beauty. So before this, males did not have and do not have standards of female beauty in most species. They don't care. It's a female, and she presents herself to you, you service her, but not in humans. Okay, so humans are the male has for a couple of million years now been increasingly and sophisticatedly selective about their partners. They are still much less discriminating than females are. So males are carrying around considerably more easily activated lust than females.
Very, very good. Okay. And so nowadays, what type of mating strategy, this is from a user, Lucilio Vanini, what type of mating strategy is humanity predisposed to? And to clarify, he's saying, are we naturally monogamous, polyamorous, polygamous, you know, monogamish? What is this? What are we mostly predisposed to?
Yes, we are a mess. We are a bunch of mixed strategies. And the way you can tell this is you can look at various, well, certainly all you have to do is look at human beings and you can see it. You can observe their behavior very clearly. They have some degree of tendency for romantic pair bonding. They are clearly not monogamous as a species. They do not behave like monogamous style species at all. If there are certain characteristics, physical characteristics that are a dead giveaway in biology that tell you whether a species is going to be essentially a casual mating species or what we're going to call a he-man species. So a he-man species is a species where the really sexy males get all of the action and the other males get none, and all of the females line up to be serviced by the he-man. So that's stock operating procedure through almost every mammalian species. But there are a few species where they are pair bonders, where the species are very, very faithful to each other, possibly for life or often through an entire mating season. That will be how they will act, and the males will not be trying to cheat around the edges. Now there are two characteristics that come to mind that are tip-offs for this. One of those characteristics is that there's physical differences in the size between males and females. So if the male of a species is significantly different in size than the female of the species, then this is going to be what we call being sexually dimorphic, i.e. two morphs. And humans are moderately sexually dimorphic. They are not as sexually dimorphic as some species. You'll see some species where the male is vastly larger than the female, where the male is three times the size of the female. So in elephant seals, for example, the male elephant seal is much greater than the female, and we would expect that this would be a he-man species, that the male has been selected for this tremendous size because there's so much at stake in being alpha that the males have been genetically in competition for size and ferociousness, and so they've just continued to get larger and larger and larger and larger with succeeding generations until the point where you've got a gigantic male versus very much smaller females. Now, that is not true in humans. So in humans, typical difference between male and female is, you know, I think it's 20% of body size or something like that in terms of body weight. There is some normal difference between males and females. There's about a 5 or 6 inch difference in their height, which is about 10%. But strength is generally considerably different. So we are a moderately sexually dimorphic species, which would tell us that we would expect to be half-assed monogamous with a bunch of cheating around on the sides and quite a bit of casual netting strategy. The other evidence is to look at look at the size of men's testicles relative to their body weight. And so if you actually plot primates, for example, on a graph about the weight of their testicles relative to their body size, this tells you how much sperm is being produced and how important it is to produce a great deal of sperm in that species. Now, if you're a species where there is where they are very faithful, then the testicles are small relative to the body size because they're not needing to try to produce a lot of semen, because they're just going to like impregnate this one female and then they're going to be done and then they're going to be helping raise the critters. Whereas if you have like in the chimpanzee, the males do not help with the children at all, and there is a tremendous competition to try to mate as often as you can as a male chimpanzee. So it's a fairly standard operating procedure in chimpanzee society for an individual to be having sex probably 8 times a day. And that would be typical. And so what's happening is a female is having sex with probably 8 different partners in a day. So there's tremendous competition within her reproductive tract of the sperm. So the sperm is literally at war with each other. And the more soldiers that you have, the better off that you are. So male chimpanzees produce tremendous amounts of sperm, and their testicles are gigantic compared to humans. So if you look at humans, we are on a log linear graph, and you plot us, we wind up right in the middle between a he-man species, like a chimp species, and a parabon species, like some other species are. And we look like we're a half-assed mixed strategy. If you were to hand this to a biologist that didn't know anything about humans, some other species, some Martian biologist, they would say, huh, well, I would expect that there would be, you know, some loving attachment, and but they would last for a while, for a portion of the lifetime, and but they probably would then have some novelty seeking, where they would really be curious about sleeping with other people, have sex with other people, and they probably would. And so there would probably be a lot of conflicts over how many resources that we would give to offspring. The male would have a strong tendency to try to chisel the female on the amount of childcare, and i.e. resources that they would direct towards offspring, and they would be looking to impregnate other females on the sly, and they'd be trying to essentially minimize the amount of investment per copulation that they could get away with, because the females on the other side of this would be psychologically engineered to try to get the maximum amount of resources out of the males per copulation. And so this would be an endless evolutionary game between the male and female of the species as they battle with each other, as the females would withhold, and they would use various and sundry sexual strategies to try to reduce copulations per unit of resource acquisition. And the males would be trying to get one up on that, because the males effectively are competing with the other males in order to get copulations, and each of them in principle wouldn't have any more resources than the other one on average. And so as a result, this is going to be quite a game of males telling females that they're going to give them a hell of a lot of resources, but then as soon as they can get to the eggs, they try to back off on those resources. So hopefully what I'm describing here suggests a tremendous amount of what people's life experience has been. And I'm sure it does.
As the married males are coming back from checking in the mirror. Is the audio okay here?
Yes, great.
I was just talking about this with a friend the other day, is that this psychological process of advertising that you're willing to share your resources is very much a first date, where you are willing to buy a dinner or a drink or a movie ticket or something like that to advertise, hey, look, I've got resources and I'm willing to share them with you.
What's astonishing to me is that, of course, in my career, I talk to a lot of women, and they will tell me that a lot of men don't do this, where men signal very clearly at the first date about how they're concerned about how much this is going to cost and who's going to pay for what. And I would just suggest to all males listening, which there might be like 13 of us, but for goodness sakes, don't signal any cheap behavior on a date, for God's sakes. This is a disaster. And you are much, much better off overspending and making it very clear that you have no problem letting go of these resources. You aren't doing yourself any good by signaling that you are trying to save $18 or $23 on not spending quite that much on her, because after all, you might not get laid. So you're like running this cost benefit analysis on copulation right there, staring at $20. For God's sake, don't do that. That's a disastrous strategy.
You know, I was reading one of these forums and I came across an article, and the logic, I believe, is that they say the article was basically saying that, well, if you're stingy with your money, that it makes the other person believe that you're stingy with your mates. And so they've got to compensate and like kind of raise their game, which made no sense to me because, you know, $10-$20 is nothing when it comes to advertising in a business. So why is that any different than dating?
help me understand. So their logic was, if you're stingy on the date, then what does the other person infer?
The other person infers that you're a picky male in general, and so they are then motivated to elevate their own game and display more agreeable tendencies.
This is great. You know, you showed me somebody had written about their objections to evolutionary psychology. This was one of our listeners who is in England, and in England, as opposed to America, evolutionary psychology is very much more part of the culture and in the teaching of the university level, largely because of the history of Darwin and then Richard Dawkins and William Hamilton and many of the major evolutionary theorists have been British. And so one way or another, that is a much more palatable message over there than it has been over here, and it's been better popularized. And the criticism was that, gee, you know, everything, if you listen to some evolutionary theorists, like everything under the sun that you see, they have a story for. And is this correct or isn't it correct? And the answer is that no, there is not an evolutionary story for everything under the sun. Not exactly. Maybe on a very, very long reach through convoluted reasoning, there might be. But I understood the objections, even though there was some fuzzy thinking that I was reading in this person's objections. But this would be a point of this type of objection, that somebody that can sit back and say, well, if you're picky, then they're going to think you're a picky in mate selection, so therefore they're going to have to up their game. And like, this is ridiculous. This is the notion here is that there are cues going back and forth between male and female as they try to read various aspects of the other person's personality, as well as how valuable they seem to the other person. So let me give you an example of this is how it is that you play cards or negotiate, you know, if you're trying to buy a used car. Like, you want to show that you're interested, but you don't want to show that you're super interested. If you act when you are buying a used car like you're really not very interested, then when you give your offer, they're going to be like, well, you're not that interested, so the next guy that's more interested is going to be willing to offer more, so the hell with your offer. If you say, oh my God, this is incredible, I love this car, what do you want for it? $14,000? Here's $14,000. They're going to think, well, now wait a second, you were so excited, I could have gotten more for it. Okay? So this is the gamesmanship that goes on. And the humans have evolved mechanisms for reading each other. And so I have seen many times where some guy is just so enamored with some girl's good looks that he's fallen all over himself. And she is designed by nature to read these cues and to realize, well, wait a second, I must be fancier than anything else that you've ever had. And if that's true, then I don't want to be with you because it means that this would be, you're beneath me. And so that behavior isn't going to work. But the I've read like, I don't know, 15 or 20 pages a few years ago of a guy named the Pickup Artist, or he wrote some quasi-evolutionary thinking on these issues. The notion that you can act cool to a female that you're interested in, and that act like you're not that interested, and that this is going to increase her what do you call it, interest in you,
Lust
because
circuits.
She's going to feel like, wait, like that maybe she won't qualify. I mean, this is very interesting speculation, but I have to tell you, empirically, it's totally full of shit. The truth of the matter is that when human beings, first of all, the female in the majority of cases drives the relationships. So we know this from scientific evidence. So the notion that a male can actually stoke her interest by acting like he's not interested is a very interesting convoluted idea, but this is actually a desperate maneuver on the part of males that have had a hard time stoking any female interest. The truth is that if you're a male who is struggling to potentially qualify for a female who you would really like to be with, but she is acting not that interested, the worst thing that you could possibly do is act like you're not interested. Human beings are designed by nature to seek esteem. They desire signals that indicates that they're valuable. What you want to do is you want to signal to her that she is valuable. You want to be honest about it. You want to be smooth about it, but you definitely don't want to underplay it, not unless you happen to be internally falling all over yourself. But if you're falling all over yourself, nothing I'm going to tell you is going to help you, because you're going to mess it up anyway. God help you that maybe you're just going to get lucky. But the truth of the matter is that the worst thing that you could ever do is to try to play it cool like she doesn't qualify. That would be that's a fiasco. You want to look people, you want to look people in the eye, and you want to let them know that you are interested. That's very important.
What are some techniques to give esteem in that scenario?
Well, one of the ways that you're going to give esteem is you're going to make
for science,
sure that
obviously.
You make it. If you're a male, for goodness sakes, you are definitely going to signal that you're generous. And if you act chintzy with a female, you are basically telling her, I don't think you're that good looking. You know, these eggs aren't that worth having. That's what you're signaling. And so don't think that she's not going to infer that. She is smart enough to realize that if you were really attracted to her, you sure as hell wouldn't be counting your money and trying to save $20. So you want to be very relaxed and generous. You want to be signaling, you know, that the person is valuable. And the way you signal that people are valuable is you both ask them questions and you tell them stories about yourself. And but you certainly ask questions and you give compliments. This is how it is that we signal to other people that we esteem them.
And along the same line, actually, this is a question that came up in the same forum of this evolutionary psychology, and this came from a female user who wanted to know. So Darwin had some very very controversial opinions about women being inferior to men, and they wanted to know your opinion in terms of contribution to society, intellect, and emotional capacity. This user would like to know: are women inferior to men in this regard?
Well, you know, that's a strange question. Let's back it up for just a second before we answer it in a way that might get me in any kind of hot water. First, we're going to look at the world and we're going to say, are males superior to females in general? And the answer would have to be, well, according to what criteria? So are males larger than females? Is that a good thing? Are males more physically capable in some ways than female? Like, by what criteria? So there's certain criteria where men and women are different. and somebody finds those differences valuable in some ways. Like, I find women a hell of a lot more valuable than men. I just send all the rest of you die. Okay? I'll have 3.5 billion women all to myself. Okay? So the point is that if you're going to try, so clearly from the standpoint of biology, neither male nor female is more valuable. They are equally valuable, which is why you find the sex ratios effectively 50-50. You know, that's how that works. If females were inherently more valuable, we'd have more females than males because it'd be a better biological reproductive system. If males were more valuable than females, then the opposite would be true. The fact that things are essentially 50-50 tells you that from the standpoint of biology, they are both equally viable methods for reproducing genes, which is their ultimate biological purpose. Now, if you start talking about American society and you say, well, who's more valuable to society? Well, what do we mean by that? And what valuable to whom? And what do we mean by society? Once again, I would just assume all the males be dead, personally. And so as a result, like, once again, we have the situation that, like, who are we talking about? Now, if we're going to try to say, well, what about contributions to science or business or blah, 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 okay? We're going to find that, in general, the following is going to be true. That males are driven to try to amass esteem and try to do very spectacular things. In order to be spectacular in ways that will enable them to inseminate females without large investments. So the point here is to try to become a he-man, and so this is a big driving force of male achievement. So if we were to look at major achievements by almost any measure through a period of human history where there's been basically free enterprise and the shackles have been lifted off of the female. So if you looked in America in the last 30 years, so since 1986, there's been no real constraint on female achievement. If you wanted to be the president of a big corporation, go ahead. Nobody's going to really stop you. Okay. If you wanted to be a chief litigator, you know, it's a big law firm, nobody's going to stop you. Now, you might say, oh, the good old boy next works will stop you, but they won't. The truth of the matter is that women have achieved spectacularly in every area of American society in the last 30 years in increasing numbers. But it's going to turn out that there's going to be a cap on that relative to males. And the reason is the males have so much more to gain than a female. A female, in principle, only wants one really good male. She wants the fanciest male that she can get. She wants to repetitively have sex with that individual. I'm talking about from a deep biological motivation perspective. She's looking to actually land one great victory and be done. The male of our species does not have that as his chief overriding goal. Some of them do if they're more pair bond dominant. Many of them don't. The species is playing a mixed strategy. And the truth is that the average male would just as soon have a harem. And the only way he's going to get a harem is he has to obliterate competition by being spectacular. It's going to turn out that when you observe males who are spectacularly successful, you will overwhelmingly find that they will be involved in multiple relationships. So one of the famous lines in the NBA is, you know, what's the hardest thing to do when you leave home to go on play on the road? And the answer is try not to smile when you kiss your wife goodbye. And this is reality. Okay. And this is a tough, you know, difficult reality. This is, the philosophers have a name for this, and we call this the tragic viewing of existence. Doesn't mean that it's a tragedy. It just means that there's conflicts of interest that are just tough. And this is one of those conflicts of interest. But in answer to the question, are males more valuable than females? The answer is males on average will do many more spectacular things than females per 1,000 or per 100,000 or per 100 in any per capita issue. And the reason why is very simple, is that a male could sire 1,000 children, and a female can only be mother to, I think the world's record is 63. And so the fact that that difference could be in principle 100 to 1, that there's a difference in the amount of reproduction that an average male versus what an average female could do biologically, that means that the male is massively interested in great achievements, and some of them will do great achievements. They will take tremendous risks, and they will pour energy into developing abilities and developing spectacular outcomes. And females are just not that motivated. As soon as they've got themselves a couple of kids from a good guy, they're more or less satisfied psychologically. And that is the reason why there is a difference in the achievement levels.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, and it sheds a lot of light onto this question. So the next question from Sublime Mongrel asks, what's the truth behind this hypergamy? Does it mean that social and cultural values will lose out?
What does that person, what are they asking? Translate for me.
They're trying to figure out what hypergamy is. And from what I've read, it's basically a desire to get a better and better mate. I.e., you know, if I date somebody when I'm 17, and they're extremely attractive, the next one that I want to date is not going to be like, you know, the unattractive, is I want to be comparable and maybe always even date higher. But I believe that the question is about women more so than men.
And so let's read the question again.
What is the truth behind hypergamy? And does it mean that social or cultural values will always lose out?
You mean because people will always be wanting to do better, that we're mm-hmm. never going to we're not going to see a society that has mating stability, which would be potentially seemingly advantageous to societal stability. Is that kind of the idea?
I guess so. Yeah, it sounds about right.
No, I'm not really sure exactly what the person's asking, but the truth is that people are running cost benefit analysis on their mating situation, and they're going to always be asking the question, could I do better? And the answer is going to be complex for every individual. For one thing, it could be that they are getting evidence from their mating environment that they could do better. So let's suppose you're a guy who is a rock singer and you've been struggling along, you know, playing your guitar in little holes in the wall, and then you get discovered, and then it turns out you go to Hollywood and you cut a record, and then you wind up with a big hit, and now suddenly you got a lot of money and a big fan following, and you know, the girl that you were with, you know, you were about a 7, she was about an 8.5, and she was hanging with you. You might even be married to her, but suddenly now you've got a hell of a lot of resources and a lot more options. And so now you are absolutely running the cost benefit on whether or not it's time to move on. Now, in those situations, usually the guy does move on. So that's very typical. That would be the inside the programming of humans is not necessary
to females, right?
I understand. No. So in other words, what I'm getting at is that human beings don't have a incessant desire to get a better mate. What they have is an incessant cost benefit analysis that they're running. Okay. So there are many people that have trekked their way through the marketplace, bumped into somebody when they're 35 and said, you know what, this is as good as I can do. And they're very happy about it. And those two people may actually remain pretty happy with their choice indefinitely. Okay. But there's many people where that's not going to happen, where for various and sundry reasons, that individual was the best individual that they could bump into at the time, and that they initiated a relationship and they were in a relationship for a while. But the truth of the matter is, a year goes by, 2 years goes by, and they are running the cost benefit analysis, and that all it takes is somebody at work flirting with them that's 5% more attractive than their partner, and suddenly their partner's not looking so good. And so so there are factors. There is not an incessant novelty factor that would necessarily say that a person could never be in stasis in a relationship and be willing to settle down. However, the novelty factor in males is greater than the novelty factor in females for reasons that I've mentioned before. And so it's going to turn out that this little burning candle inside of male psychology is going to be tougher on the quote cultural ideal of everybody like happily pair bonded and everybody stable, okay? Which is essentially a bullshit concept anyway, when it really gets down to it. Because the truth of the matter is that, you know, who is this good for? It isn't, you know, I'm not sure what, it's not good for divorce lawyers. Like, who exactly is best off under a completely stable situation? So there are people who benefit from that, and there are people who don't benefit from that.
Are children more better off in a more stable environment?
Yes, children are better off in a stable environment, but children can have stable environments that are being single parented. So okay. Children are actually best off under circumstances where they have stability with respect to resources, and that there is not acrimony between the parents. So if there's acrimony between the parents, but they're living in the same house, that is a worse situation for children than with those parents divorced, living in different houses, but there being peace. So people need to keep that in mind, that what children, what's uncomfortable for children is instability in resources and emotionally instability in the parents. That's what makes childhood tough. Incidentally, it's not going to scar them. It's just unpleasant. It's like being in a hot room, like you're uncomfortable, but it's not going to kill you. Being in a childhood that's uncomfortable for reasons of your parents being unsettled and uncomfortable is uncomfortable, but it isn't damaging you. And so it's useful for parents to know that their children are not damaged if they go through divorce. They're made uncomfortable. That's a big difference. There's an enormous difference between discomfort and damage. Big difference.
Okay.
So I forget where the original question, I lost track of the original question.
Oh, we were talking about hypergamy and how social and cultural values as a result of it.
Yes, I think I now understand the word hypergamy, which is this sort of potential incessant desire to trade up. And I would say that is not actually a characteristic of our species. A characteristic that is interesting is novelty seeking, particularly on the part of the male, but also on the female. So that adds instability to monogamous pair bonding, as well as the cost benefit analysis that people run as circumstances grow and change and people's fortunes rise and fall. Nothing will get a guy more monogamous oriented than losing his job. Suddenly his wife's the best thing that he could ever get, and he loves her and he'll stick with her forever. Nothing more likely to cause a female to leave a guy than a guy losing his job. Suddenly the cost benefit for her has changed, that she could now maybe find somebody that's employed as opposed to unemployed, and she's looking for resources to trade resources for her sexuality. And by God, that is exactly when women are most likely to leave their mates, when they lose their jobs.
So work hard and don't lose your job, men.
Yeah, and incidentally, for women, the most likely time that you'll be cheated on will be when you're pregnant. Mm-hmm. So that makes also perfect evolutionary sense. So the male basically stares at the female's big belly and says, no point in having sex there. The job's already been done. Let me look across the street. So you don't, if you're a female, you do not want to mimic pregnancy by having extra weight. That's why you want to eat a diet of whole natural foods and exercise and keep yourself in good shape. That'll keep the guy interested in you. And as a male, work hard, be responsible financially, and be responsible professionally. Because that's going to be a very important variable that the women are always going to be analyzing.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.